Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Identifying Patients with Intermediate Risk in Non-Muscle Invasive Bladder Cancer. I'm Dr. Max Kates. I'm a urologist and associate professor of urology and the director of urologic oncology at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi everyone, I'm Neil Shore. I'm a urologist at the Carolina Urologic Research Center in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
So today our discussion is really going to focus on exploring challenges in identifying intermediate risk patients. And we will discuss the importance of risk stratification to improve outcomes for these patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Joining us in this conversation today is Dr. Tom Jayram. Dr. Jayram is a urologic oncologist and an experienced robotic surgeon. He practices at Urology Associates in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you so much for joining us, Tom.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure to be here.
So let's get started. How do you approach really risk stratifying this really diverse group of patients with NMIBC?
It's an interesting question, and as you know, one size definitely doesn't fit all in this group of patients. Risk stratification is something that is a field we probably don't do well enough before we start patients on treatment. But really, in this intermediate group, I think the important thing is not just kind of what their pathology report shows. Obviously, that's really important, but the patient, their age, their preferences, their comorbidities, their pathway kind of to see you. Have they had a lot of treatments for this before? What their overall, sense of this is in terms of, how aggressive they want to be. So, obviously we risk stratify based on the AUA guidelines. I tend to be, I'd love to see low risk, low grade disease. I think we have some discussion about high grade disease also as part of the intermediate risk pathway. But I tend to look at these patients, say, how many recurrences have they had? What's been their journey to get here? How many treatments have they had? And then we kind of move them into more of a higher risk bucket where they may need a little bit more intensified treatment, or, as a lower risk bucket in terms of patients who, these polyps come once every couple of years, they're not symptomatic, you find them incidentally, those patients may not need to be intensified.
Yeah, I think that's
Yeah,
a
I
great
think that.
overview, Tom. I really appreciate that. As you say, it's individualizing. Before we got on this program today, I was thinking about conversations I previously had with Max and with you. We always talk about in prostate cancer the heterogeneity of prostate cancer, but first of all, clearly there's an incredible amount of heterogeneity in bladder cancer. And even within this bucket of patients, the intermediate risk, the low grade to or the low risk to the high risk. And before we get into some more of these questions, and Max is going to lead it, I'm curious, you're in a large, very successful group. I think you have about 30 different physicians and a whole bunch of APPs. I'm struck by where we are now in bladder cancer today, and our colleagues, because of the complexity that's happened in bladder cancer, the whole treatment spectrum. But when we try to stage patients appropriately and think about their risk stratification, where do you think our colleagues are right now in 2025 in understanding truly the difference between low risk versus intermediate risk versus high risk, let alone what defines BCG unresponsive, and then the sort of the some of the nuanced differences of the different guidelines?
Yeah, it's a great question, Neil. I think we've made a ton of progress, as you know, and we talk about this at some of our yearly meetings. Things are definitely getting better in the community, and I think part of that is this attention to the BCG unresponsive space, right? We have so many clinical trials now in this space that it's forcing a lot of our groups to say, okay, well, where did this patient come from? Where did they go? What was their journey? And so I would say we're better off than we were. We still have some room to go. The BCG shortage, honestly, we talk about this all the time. It helped groups like ours because we were forced to cast a microscope on our BCG practices and how we were using intravesical therapy. And we found that obviously a lot of providers did things that were not pathway or not evidence-based. So that helped. I still think this space is tricky because you have that slight overlap between small high-grade lesions and, you know, low-grade lesions. And that can kind of, I think that throws some people off. People who don't do this every day or don't do this all the time. And I think it's confusing too sometimes, right? You have a small high-grade tumor and you can potentially follow a intermediate risk or a lower kind of risk pathway for those patients if they're well selected. So this is a trickier group of patients. We have some data that has come out in the last couple of years that some of the risk factors I mentioned, number of recurrences, time to recurrence, failure of prior intravesical therapy, all of those things can kind of further risk stratify people and maybe may even predict progression, because at the end of the day, that's what we're all really concerned about, is are these low-grade patients going to turn into high-grade patients at some point? But ultimately, there is still a lot of work to be done. As you know, there's a lot of heterogeneity in clinical practice over how do you monitor patients? Are you using blue light? Are you using enhanced cystoscopic techniques? Are you using cystocytology for your follow-up? Are you using another cytologic marker or one of these newer markers? So there's still a lot of a room for improvement and standardization, but I think we're definitely better than we were several years ago.
All right. Let's stick to this this problem in even diagnosis. So we've all gotten the pathology report that says low-grade non-invasive tumor with a foci of high-grade cells. What do you do with that? Do you talk to your pathologist? Does it matter from one pathologist to the other? And how do you kind of view that patient?
Yeah, absolutely. What I realized really early on with trying to improve bladder cancer quality in my group, and I think this conversation has been had mutually with several others, is that pathology matters. Pathology is a really important part of your program. And so just like in prostate cancer, you know, it matters who's reading the MRIs and who's reading the PET scans and what their experience is. It really matters who's looking at the slides. And so my approach would be to get the slides re-reviewed if they weren't reviewed by somebody that, you know, I would consider a higher volume GU uropathologist. And then my bias and I'd be curious to see you guys' opinions. But my bias is if I see high grade, even if it's focal, even if it's smaller volumes, if it's high grade, I tend to follow more of a high risk pathway utilizing BCG or intravesical doublet chemotherapy first, as opposed to just using single agent chemo or having a more conservative approach. I'm sure there are some patients that would do just fine. But I guess, you know, when you see high grade bladder cancer and you see what the potential is, you obviously want to do everything you can. So I usually get a pathologic re-review from someone who I think, does a lot of these. And if there are high grade features, I tend to move more down the high risk pathway.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same. We have a dedicated in-house pathologist. I do get second opinions. I usually send my second opinion pathologies to Johns Hopkins, especially when I'm concerned about a more aggressive interpretation, you know, going into T1 and certainly on my muscle invasive patients or sometimes where there's some, concern regarding their high grade to low grade. You know, it's interesting how we used to have the intermediate grade. There are folks who want to sort of bring that back with the World Health Organization that categorization. I don't know, Max, do you have any influence with that or thoughts on that?
Yeah, the way I think about this, Neil, and I think this is a term that you've used quite often, is sort of the shared decision-making approach with patients. So this would be a great example of you know, you have a patient with recurrent low-grade tumors. It's showing, you know, some high-grade cells. Do you want to view that as sort of a progression of their disease or just a recurrence? And you know, it comes down to many different factors, you know, things like the interval of the time to the recurrence and the patient factors, their age and comorbidities. And so I really think that, you know, today we're talking about some of the science around intermediate risk disease, but I think we all recognized, you know, there's a heavy art to this as well. And that's, I think, where the patient-centered discussions come in.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I know this next question about challenges or roadblocks that we as urologists encounter in communication with our pathologists, especially regarding NMIBCs and how they're interpreted. I think we've only recently, and I say in the last few years, really have tried with our own in-house tumor boards, much like the academic centers, to try to get our pathologists much more involved. I think many of them don't appreciate how their interpretation, their calls, can really change the therapeutic discussion. You know, whether you're getting a singlet or doublet intravesical chemotherapy or no therapy at all, or BCG, or, you know, even potentially, you know, as it relates to outside of intermediate risk. I think the exciting area of intermediate risk, and I hope we get a little time to talk about it, Max, because you've been very involved in this. This is a very fertile area for trial development. And Tom, you've been very involved as well. Love to hear your thoughts on, you know, is it just continued TURBT? Will we be thinking about other intravesical therapies besides chemotherapy, which are theoretically not really approved, but yet in the guideline? Which is sort of a fascinating thing. We use gemcitabine and mitomycin and docetaxel, and but there are some other new things, you know, in the pipeline.
Yeah, and I'd definitely be interested to hear what Max thinks. I think my obviously the next 12 to 24 months are going to be really interesting in intermediate risk disease. We may have some approvals that come through on some cool new agents. I think as a community, as a field, I think we underestimate the impact of TURBT and anesthesia on this group of patients. I've seen it over and over again, and I'm sure you guys have too, where, you know, taking these patients for repeated anesthesia procedures has a big impact on them and their family, and they make comments about it. So I would really welcome new options in this space that could potentially minimize the, you know, you always want to be cautious about talking about replacing TURBT, but I think I would be welcome to the thought of newer agents, newer options that could potentially minimize TURBT, prolong intervals for TURBT, and ultimately allow this disease to be managed more as a office-based kind of phenomenon. Because again, if you're not looking at progression, which you usually are not in this group, it really comes down to quality of life. And I think that's the biggest opportunity, I think, to improve for us right now. Max, I'm not sure what you think. But
yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, if you compare it to sort of BPH procedures, maybe it's acceptable for a patient to undergo certainly one, maybe two in their lifetime. But if you told a patient they're going to undergo five or six in their lifetime, they'd think you're crazy. So the fact that we're in some patients, you know, doing the same surgery over and over. What is a TURBT's purpose? It's to diagnose and stage a tumor. It's not to treat a tumor continuously once it's recurred. I don't know that surgery is a proven cure for that, for a field defect. So I think we're using TURBT too liberally and probably not effectively. I think it can be incredibly effective. And the data shows this for the first time out. For a new bladder tumor, you can cure somebody with a TURBT. But once they start recurring, and this is especially true in intermediate risk and low-grade disease, the value of the TURBT needs to seriously be questioned, especially when we consider that we are damaging the bladder over and over again and creating scar tissue. And we all have patients who see the effects of that. So yes, I would completely agree that this is an area where we need alternatives. We need other options. And I agree with both of you on that. You know, one sort of technical question that I had is this, there's this real confusion with whether small high-grade non-invasive tumors should even be called intermediate risk. Right now, they are in the AUA guidelines, but let's be honest, there's many different trials going on right now in this disease space, and most of them do not allow high-grade non-invasive tumors because urologists are pretty terrible at estimating the accurate size of a tumor. And so it's incredibly subjective whether you have a high-grade non-invasive tumor that's 2 centimeters or 4. I'm wondering how you guys navigate that and what you think about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was kind of what I was hinting at with some of my earlier comments is I don't feel great with a high-grade TA diagnosis, you know, especially in patients who are a little bit younger, healthier, fitter. I don't feel super comfortable putting them through the intermediate risk pathway of kind of infrequent surveillance and the only real treatment being observation or single agent chemo. That's just something I've never been super comfortable with. I understand the rationale that some of these small high-grade tumors may biologically be a little bit, you know, like Neil was talking about, intermediate, you know, in terms of their grade. They may not be as biologically active as some of these larger sessile high-grade lesions. But so I agree with you. You know, I've made that same comment that I don't have a ruler in my cystoscope to estimate the size of this. I'm just going to treat this patient like this patient was a high grade superficial tumor usually with intravesical therapy, either BCG or doublet chemotherapy. So, yeah, I agree, and I think it's reflected in, like you said, the newer trial designs and a lot of the trials now to keep their data as clean and as kind of meaningful and apples to apples comparisons as possible. They're trying to exclude some of the high grade patients, which I think tells you a lot about what we're doing in real practice and what people think, you know, should be kind of the standard for these patients.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, you think that there eventually will be some sort of a mechanism, you know, maybe it's the people who work the clear in the airports that will just focus our light on the tumor and it'll immediately register the exact size. You know, they certainly are able to identify who we are just by scanning our retinas. But yeah, it's all over the place. It's incredibly subjective. And I agree with you, Max. We do a terrible job of that, whether we're trying to, you know, use a loop as 5 millimeters. And it's usually after you've completed the case and you're doing your dictation, you know, you've got to put in the size. So I think that's a real weakness in the stratification system. And you know, some other things, I don't know that I've ever really seen a low grade T1 lesion. I know that's part of the EAU guidelines, but I just don't know that I've ever seen one in my entire career.
Agreed.
Yeah, I think that these are all great points. More functionally, Tom, in your practice, you know, you have a practice of 30 urologists. I'm sure that you do everything in your power to sort of standardize, you know, quality of care and especially around bladder cancer. But nevertheless, probably most of those 30 are doing surveillance cystoscopies, you know, picking up tumors. How do you communicate what system do you have to kind of let colleagues know that there are options for patients most straightforward with recurrent low-grade tumors. So if a tumor comes back and it's low-grade, this patient is now not low risk anymore, they're intermediate risk. How is that done in your practice?
we have a navigator, a bladder cancer navigator, which has been very helpful. They look at registry data from our practice. So everyone who has intravesical therapy, whether it be BCG or chemotherapy, those patients are marked and they're kind of watched. And anyone who puts an order in for something like that, the chart's reviewed, you know, and that was something that carried over from the shortage just to make sure that we're utilizing BCG well, but obviously it's spun off and it has several other benefits. And then we have a navigator who goes through our analytics software, PPS, is what we use, and patients who have a diagnosis of bladder cancer are all loaded in. And at every, you know, quarterly increments, ideally, and obviously there are some, you know, changes and, you know, who's doing it and what hats they're wearing for that particular month and whatnot. But ideally, the system is designed so that they can check what's happening to every patient with an active diagnosis of bladder cancer. So we've pulled several patients who haven't had a surveillance cysto in 18 months, haven't had follow-up after a positive biopsy. As you know, I mean, this stuff happens in the real world. As patients get a biopsy and they say, hey, you know, let's talk about it in the office a week later, they don't show up, and then they just don't show up. And so navigation has helped quite a bit. The BCG registry and BCG reviews have really helped. And then the last thing I would say is, if you're in a practice with clinical trials, it obviously helps quite a bit because you really have options for these patients. And so I keep my group really informed through email, through chart messaging, through quarterly group meetings, to tell them, here's what's new with our trials. We have, you know, X amount of intermediate trials. Let's go over again the definition of intermediate risk disease. And we kind of hammer through a lot of that. So I think, you know, Neil, I'm sure, is in the same position. When you have a lot of clinical trials, you have almost another reason to continue to update the group in, you know, whichever way you can. So those are some of the ways that we've done it. And I think a lot of the bigger groups have adopted trials have found that everything kind of goes together, having the navigator, because that, you know, all of these things work in harmony to improve the quality of bladder cancer care in the group.
Neil, you know, you've been incredibly involved in the large urology groups, and just curious if you have any best practices around this.
Well, I think Tom articulated it extremely well. I mean, this has been evolving. We use a navigator. She's one of the most important. She just does bladder cancer, and she's regularly reviewing the pathology reports. We have in-house pathology for the most part. Anything that's done outside, she will review them for our clinical trials, but also for adequate staging to make sure our colleagues are understanding that, you know, if they're not regular bladder cancer acolytes like we all are. And I think more and more practices are moving into that direction, given the complexity and the heterogeneity of bladder cancer. But yes, navigators are great. And then analytical systems like, you know, as Tom mentioned, the PPS, and there are others that, you know, you hate missing these patients who somehow what's called they don't come back for their follow-up or their no next appointment. I think we all cringe when we see somebody come in 2-3 years later and they're like, well, you know, nobody called me. We had a high-grade papillary lesion. Oh my gosh, what's it going to look like when I do your next cystoscopy? You know, we all go through that, and our hearts sort of sink when we see those patients and they're like, yeah, I don't know. My primary care doctor told me I should be following back up with you. So the EHRs are getting better, and we need to continue to refine them, and we all work through it, and we, you know, we can all complain about them, but they're sort of they're here to stay. But I agree with everything that Tom said. You know, Tom has been a great partner for me with Bladder Cancer Academy. We've been running that now for over 10 years. And here's something really important. We got to get Max over there. So let's make sure we get the date for you this fall. But Bladder Cancer Academy is wonderful. We only have about 100 and 120 folks come. It's a day and a half of intensive review of all aspects of bladder and a half a day on kidney cancer. And it addresses questions like this. We had a session there on how do you use your EHR and your navigator? And we had a really great interactive dialogue, not just with the speakers and the panel, but the entire audience. And so baked into your question, Max, is, we all have to learn from each other.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm always reminded that urologists are taught to fear the stent that's missed, so we're so hyped up on that. And yet there's not that same anxiety with a patient that sort of shows up a year after their diagnosis for their cystoscopy. And you're like, wait a minute, you needed to be here 3 months later. So I do think that there's, some efforts that we need as a community to increase our quality, just around, surveillance schedules and things like that. In sort of some of the last couple minutes that we have, one thing that I always try to do, and I'm curious, I'll get to my question in a second, is, when a patient is first diagnosed with a low-grade non-invasive tumor, I do try to set the stage for intermediate risk. Then it's low risk. But I say, if you have a recurrence, then we probably will be trying some therapeutic options. Right now, it's low risk and observation alone is what I would recommend. So that way, it's sort of, they're sort of on your team in a way, from a quality perspective. They're already prompted to be thinking, hey, I have a recurrence. He had told me, now I got to do something different. So that's one strategy I employ. But beyond that, what patient resources, do you suggest for patients to help them learn about their disease or to kind of educate them about intermediate risk and MIBC, Tom?
Yeah, it's a good question. I totally echo taking that extra 5 to 10 minutes on that first encounter to set expectations and to kind of tell them, listen, this is, for better or for worse, kind of the gift that keeps giving, low-grade bladder cancer. This is lifelong surveillance. Hopefully we de-escalate it over the years. But these are nuisance tumors, right? I kind of always make it a point to go the nuisance versus dangerous, route, low grade, high grade. They're a nuisance and, they're not extremely dangerous if we stay on top of it, but they could just be annoying. And so it's our job to just make sure that we look in, periodically. So setting those expectations, I think, is really important. And as we all know, and it's nice to see there's been a little bit more attention to this, in the last couple of years, but the journey, the path of these patients can be incredibly arduous and complex with treatments and catheters and cystos. And it's really on us to prepare these patients mentally, because it's a lot. We've all seen patients, who have just been really fed up with intravesical treatments and catheters, and they're just, their bladders aren't working well, and they're just so fatigued. I think we can do a lot, and we've talked about this, and try to de-escalate care when it's necessary. Don't do that extra cysto if it's not necessary, all of those things. And then in terms of resources, there's the AUA guidelines are terrific. I generally have some handouts for that. And then I point all my patients to the BCAN website. BCAN, Bladder Cancer Advisory Network, has been a terrific partner, as you guys know very well, for all bladder cancer doctors. It really is something that we do not utilize enough of. We've been lucky to make some inroads too with BCAN in the community over the past couple of years, and we're doing some initiatives with them as well. So I always give them those resources, but I think the biggest thing is what you said, preparing them mentally for not just an open, closed kind of case, but more of a story that's going to keep going.
Neil, any parting wisdom on this?
That was really well said. Yeah, I love BCAN, great organization, BCAN. It's a nonprofit organization, great educational materials. I think, you know, it's demystifying, as Tom said very eloquently, you know, these are mostly nuisance. It's about the recurrence and less the progression. People hear the C word and, you know, they get very frightened. They suddenly think, oh my gosh, you have the cancer word. And then I think it's important that we spend the appropriate amount of time saying, well, we're not going to ignore it. We may be able to do surveillance. We may want a treatment for sure. But the likelihood of you succumbing to the disease with intermediate risk is with progression is extremely low single digit percentages. So we want to avoid the morbidity, and we're constantly thinking about new therapeutics that we're all working on in the trial literature. And I think that it's an exciting time and perhaps another topic for another conversation, but it's really having a really good full-throated conversation with patients and helping them not walk out of the office, you know, crying that they've been diagnosed with cancer. If that's the situation, we haven't done a good job.